This hearing of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is now 3:31, Tuesday, April 29th. Members present are Senator Hughes, Senator Klayman, Senator Tobin, Vice Chair Senator Giesel, and myself, Chair Dunbar. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I would like to recognize Mary Gwen Kawakami, the Recording Secretary, and Doug Bridges from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We have three items on our agenda. First is SB 178, Expand Early Intervention Services. Second, SB 45, Medicaid Mental Health Parity. And then finally, SB 147, Pharmacist Prescription Authority. First up is SB 178, sponsored by this committee. This is an initial hearing on this legislation. I will give the committee aide, Ariel Wiggin, a moment to come forward and introduce the bill and walk us through the sectional. At ease. About 3:33, Ms. Wiggin.
Hello. For the record, my name is Arielle Wiggin, staff to Senator Dunbar and committee aide to the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. I am here to introduce Senate Bill 178, sponsored by this committee, and then pass it off to our testifiers. Senate Bill 178 does three major items. It enables the ILP, the Infinite Learning Program, to access more federal Medicaid funding, reducing the need for additional state general funds, and requires the Department of Health to review the conditions that qualify as disability and make recommendations to the Alaska State Legislature on updating these conditions. It requires the Department of Health to submit a detailed report on this to the legislature by July 1st, 2029. The most important part of this bill, the central part of this bill, is expanding access to the ILP system by lowering the eligibility criteria to children with a 25% developmental delay. Currently, the threshold is set in regulation at 50%. There's no major database restriction for only offering these services to children with 50% delay, and this has a chilling effect in causing providers to hesitate referring children who they believe to have between a 25 and 50% delay to this program because they are unsure if the child will meet the state's developmental delay requirements and be turned away. These changes, as included, are based on recommendations from the Alaska Department of Health's Interagency Coordinating Council. The bill was put together with input from stakeholders across Alaska who work with disabled children and families and was a product of the Children's Caucus. At this point, I would like to turn to our presentation, unless the committee has any questions. Thank you.
I don't see any questions. So do you have a slideshow presentation, or you mean we're turning to the invited testimony? Okay. So we have two individuals online for invited testimony. We have Amy Simpson, the Executive Director for Programs for Infants and Children, and we have Richard Seville, Program Coordinator for the Governor's Council for Disabilities and Special Education. We also have Susan Kessler, Unit Management for Early Intervention Infant Learning Program at the Division of Senior and Disability Services, available online for questions. So if we could now move on to our presentation. Oh, it's online. Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Simpson.
Sure. For the record, my name is Amy Simpson. I am the Executive Director for Programs for Infants and Children, serving the Anchorage area and some surrounding communities. I'd like to thank you for your interest in helping children with disabilities in our state. By introducing Senate Bill 178. I am here with Rich Seville from the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education Services. We have just a short presentation, as you've all heard this before. So as a quick reminder, the Infant Learning Program serves children across the state through a network of grantees of the Senior and Disability Services. Any baby born anywhere in the state is covered by an infant learning program providing high quality services to infants and toddlers with disabilities. As Ms. Higgins described, there are a few highlights in the bill. The first is making those changes to the Medicaid statute to allow the infant learning program to bill for all Part C or early intervention services that we currently provide. At this time, and I believe that requires a change to the Medicaid state plan in order for us to be able to do that. Currently, we infant learning programs across the state are able to bill for occupational therapy, physical therapy, and speech language therapy, leaving the majority of the services that we provide statewide is special instruction or developmental therapies, falls 100% to state general funds to provide those services. The next area within the bill removes the provision for discretionary inclusion for kids who are at risk for developmental delay. And there are some at-risk language scattered throughout the statute that has been cleaned up. We believe that the inclusion of a definition of developmental delay clears up this confusion within the statute. The statute also removes language referring to a training program for paraprofessionals. A number of years back, the state went through a process through the SEED registry, which is the system of early education. Oh gosh, Susan might have to help me. She'll add to that. But it defines what is highly qualified, and so that training program for paraprofessionals is obsolete and not needed. It also adds that language to review qualifying conditions at least once every 5 years and update those conditions through the ICC members of the medical community and the state IOP office. And as was stated earlier, the most important part and the part that makes me very excited as an early intervention provider is to align Part C criteria with Part B criteria, which lowers eligibility to a 25% delay instead of the restrictive 50% delay that we currently have. And that will open up early intervention services to more children so we can get them caught up in their developmental milestones before they reach kindergarten and hopefully defer in a large special education cost as they go through their schooling. That's really the gist of what I have to say, and I thank you for your interest in this bill, and we are open for any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Simpson. I'll note for the record for public that might be watching, the document that is posted online is actually an earlier presentation that was sent to us. I believe it was a presentation given to the Children's Caucus that has more of the details about why we're doing this rather than sort of the technical details of what the bill does. We will be sure to get this newer presentation online after we have this presentation. Ms. Wiggin, could we return and read the sectional? I realize we haven't actually done that. Let's go through the sectional, and then we will open up to more testimony.
Thank you. Once again, this is Ariel Wiggins, Staff to Senator Dunbar and Committee for Senate Health and Social Services. When I will begin the sectional analysis for SB 178. Section 1 amends AS 4707030. It adds early intervention services for children with developmental delays to medical services provided by the Alaska Department of Health. Section 2 amends AS 4720060. Deletes discretionary authority of the department to serve children under the age of 3 who are at risk of developmental delays or disabilities. This is the statute governing the department's authority to provide quality learning and related early intervention family support services to eligible children under the age of 3 with developmental delays. Section 3 amends AS 4720070C, the statute governing the establishment of early intervention services programs. It deletes the mandate for the Department of Health to establish a training program for paraprofessionals who provide services to children under the age of 3 with developmental delays and disabilities. It adds a new subsection 8 requiring the Department of Health to review the conditions that qualify as a disability and makes recommendations to the Alaska Legislature on updating those conditions. The review must be conducted at least every 5 years in consultation with medical professionals and the Department of Health's Interagency Coordinating Council. Section 4, this section amends AS 4720080A, the statute governing eligibility for early intervention services. It stipulates that a child and a child's family are eligible for services if the child is experiencing a developmental delay or disability. Section 5, this amends AS 4720100, the statute governing individualized family service plans. It removes the right of the Department of Health to eliminate coverage for services. There is insufficient funding to provide services to all eligible persons. Section 6 amends AS 4720-2904, changes the definition of developmentally disabled to align with the Federal Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, IDEA, and to expand eligibility to those children with a developmental delay of at least 25% below chronological or corrected age or the equivalent standard deviation below age-appropriate norms. The standard is 20% for children in two or more of the areas listed. Section 8 repeals and reenacts AS 4720-2906. It lists the services that qualify as early intervention services. It lists those services. Section 8 repeals three sections, 4720-080B, 2901, 2902. Subsection B allows the department to eliminate coverage if there's insufficient funding. Paragraph 1 is the definition of additional early intervention services. This definition is no longer necessary because the early intervention services are detailed in Section 7 of this Act. Subparagraph 2 is the definition of core early intervention services. This definition is no longer applicable because this Act eliminates those core services in favor of a broader list. Section 9 of this bill adds a new section to uncodified law requiring the Department of Health to submit a report to the Alaska State Legislature by July 1st, 2009. Includes details about how many children in Alaska need early intervention services and the types of services provided. The report must also include the cost to the state of Alaska of providing the services and the amount of federal funding received by the state. The report must also include recommendations for further statutory changes to enhance and expand early intervention services for children under the age of 3 who have developmental delays or disabilities. Section 10. This is a new section added to uncodified law, requires the Department of Health to amend and resubmit federal approval the state plan for medical assistance coverage to align with changes made by this act. Section 11 adds a new section, also to uncodified law. It stipulates that these changes will only take effect if the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services approves the amendment or determines that approval is unnecessary. Section 12 stipulates that Section 1 takes effect on July 1st, 2026, if those changes are approved, and sets an effective date of July 1, 2026 for this act. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Any questions for Ms. Wiggin? I'm not seeing any. Mr. Seville, I want to go back to you. Do you have anything to add to that presentation, or do you have any other additional invited testimony you'd like to give?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, yes, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Thank you. This is Richard Seville, for the record, staff person for the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. I'd just like to add a few things to the presentation, and I know many of you have heard most of this before, but Alaska has the most stringent eligibility requirement for Part C services in the country, and that's not hyperbole. That is actually a fact. And when I first learned that, I was shocked. Being someone who came up in the developmental disability community in this state, my dad was a financial officer for Hope Community Resources for almost 20 years. And my first job was with Hope as a care provider, among other things. And I've always felt that Alaska was on the forefront of care for people with developmental disabilities and how we see them in our communities. And so to learn that our eligibility requirement for Part C is so stringent, it just shocked me. So I think that's a really important thing to understand our history and working with people with disabilities, and that we need to kind of get back to being leaders in that field from this perspective. And so that's why I think it's important that we lower the eligibility to 25%, not only to bring equity to services for children as the part to align that with the Part B eligibility, but also just to show that we value our families and children and their contributions currently and in the future in our community. So I think Amy touched on the cost savings in special education, but just as a reminder for previous testimony, each child that doesn't need special education K through 12, we could be saving $229,000 a year, which if you take all of the kids every year that won't need special education, if we make this change over time, we will get to a point where that adds up to over $34 million a year we could be saving at special education dollars annually that could be used for something else. So that's a massive amount of money for a state that's so having such difficulty with its budget right now. So I'd like to just be sure that's a point we mentioned. And I'd also like to say that this bill, if passed, there are a lot of other benefits to the community that we will see if expansion happens. We should see a reduced need for adult home and community-based Medicaid waiver services. We should see a reduced crime and victimization of children and fewer children entering the juvenile justice system, which leads to less burden on child protective services, public safety workers, and adult corrections potentially. We'll see a reduced need for special needs daycare, which will allow parents to go back to work and then re-enter the workforce, which we're desperate for people to be working anywhere right now. And speaking of the workforce, we will be graduating a much higher number of high school graduates ready to either enter the workforce or enter post-secondary or vocational programs to contribute to society. So these are all fantastically amazing things that can happen if we pass this bill. So that's all I have. Thank you for your time, and I'm open to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Seville. Do we have any questions for either Ms. Simpson or Mr. Seville? Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Mr. Seville. That was and helpful to understand the prescient need for this change to statute and to our approach. I'm just curious from your experience, and maybe Ms. Simpson also could jump in here. I'm under the understanding that the state already does do low incident disability screening. It's just at a higher benchmark for delay. Do you anticipate, or do you think there'd be such significant numbers of folks that would meet the reduced benchmark that would justify additional positions at the department, or would there be a need? As I see, one of the fiscal notes states that the department anticipates they would need two additional full-time positions to meet the needs under this bill. And it seems like quite a significant number of new folks to do something that we're already doing. So I'd just love to hear from your input or your insight, what would be the potential impact to the state if this legislation were to pass?
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Through the chair, I will mostly defer that to the department to answer that, but I will say that And our research in working on this over the last couple of years has shown that we would expect a 77% increase in the children the infant living program is serving. So while I can't speak directly to how the workload is dispersed with the state office, I can pretty comfortably say that they're going to need to have some help to handle that influx of kids. Even though they're already doing a lot of the work, there will be additional things that they will need to be able to do. That answers your question. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Seville. Ms. Simpson, do you have anything to add to that?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Amy Simpson. I agree wholeheartedly with Rich. I think that another impact to the state office will be the added Medicaid billing that will happen that will require the state office to have more hands on deck to implement that provision and support the programs across the state in being able to draw down those federal dollars to offset the state dollars.
Thank you, Ms. Simpson. I don't see any other questions. So at this time, we're going to move to public testimony. I'm going to open public testimony. I don't see anyone online, but we have two people signed up in the room. We'll start with Ms. Cheryl Welcome from Matsu Services for Children and Adults, if you want to come forward. I know I told you when we met offline that you had unlimited time, but that's when I thought you were invited testimony. So unfortunately, you were limited to 2 minutes. Is that going to work for you?
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. So let me get my timer out. And please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Okay. My name is Cheryl Welcome, and I am in the Matsu Valley. I'm a developmental specialist working there for 8 years. I want to say that I am absolutely passionate about the future of Alaska, and it starts with our young children. I have had the pleasure of working with many families where we are able to do home visits and give them the services that they need to empower the relationship between the parent and the child, or the parent or the child then is able to graduate and is meeting developmental milestones. I've also had many hard evaluations where we go in and those children aren't meeting that 50% delay. They're 25, 30, 35, 40, 45% delay. We have to turn them away. Maybe they don't have other insurances. And of course, the wait list for private therapies in our state is very, very long. But inevitably, year after year, I see that those families that we've turned away are returning to us. And their delay is more significant. So then they're qualified into our program. Unfortunately, we've lost a lot of very, very teachable years in there where we could help hone in those services for those children, have those strategies that are evidence-based that prepares Alaska for the future for our children who are going to be representing us later. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Welcome. Is there any questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. We now have, let's see here, Ms. Yulia Smith from the Matsu Services for Children and Adults. Ms. Smith, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony, you'll have 2 minutes.
Hello, my name is Yulia Smith. I'm one of the three developmental specialists in the Matsu Valley. We really should have 6. We're serving 1,800 children across Alaska, and there are 85 to 95 children enrolled in the Matsu Infant Learning Program, which is part of the Matsu Services for Children and Adults. And I first came into the program. I have a master's in teaching. I was invited to join the team after my child was speech delayed and had the 50% delay at a year and a half, and we started working with a developmental specialist. And I can't tell you enough how much that was, how impactful it was for him and my family. First of all, now he is in kindergarten. He is six. He is a high-functioning autistic child whom we had intervened with before he was ever given his diagnosis, because these ladies were, and Cheryl, one of them, were the first ones to notice some of the symptoms of autism. Now, I am, as part of the team, trained in screening for autism. Of course, we can diagnose, but we can start those early interventions, which is, we're a parent coaching model, where we come into the home, we see the routines that families have, we come up with strategies that they can use in a very tailored approach to their children. Their interactions are tailored to the children's needs. And that's what I felt the developmental specialist did for me as a parent. I was very empowered. I have never worked with autistic children, never had a family member diagnosed with autism in the past. And here is my six-year-old in kindergarten who special services, special education services will be taken away from next year, as I was told. But that's great news for me, because as of 3 months ago, he's now included in the classroom 100% of the time. He has an option to go to the special education room when he says, when he is bored. And what he told his classroom teacher about, how do you feel about going to first grade? He said, I'm afraid it may be too easy for me. He's a confident little guy who reads at a level of fifth grade. And who knows, some say, well, maybe he was to be a high-functioning, you know, Asperger's comes to mind, but he is diagnosed with autism too. But I believe without early intervention, he would not have had the confidence. Now behavior issues are not a concern, because as soon as we saw he was delayed in speech and couldn't express himself until he was 2.5, there were a lot of behavioral issues, tantrums, frustrations. So I was coached as to how to co-regulate with him, bring in more language into our, you know, daily routines. And now behavior issues are in the past.
Thank you, Ms. Smith.
Thank you so much.
That is your time. Do you have any, just very quickly, do you support the bill or?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And thank you for backing early intervention services.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Smith? I don't see any. Thank you for your time and your testimony. I don't see any other testifiers at this time. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? Please come forward and put yourself on the record.
Hi, my name is Laura Norton-Cruz. I'm the producer of a film about the infant learning program in the MATSU, so I'm traveling with these two employees of the infant learning program. And I can tell you a little bit about what I saw while making the film, while interviewing them, and while filming families, that speaks to the importance of SB 178. While we were filming, Yulia had to do an evaluation after 1 year of a 12-month-old child who was exposed to alcohol prenatally. As we know about fetal alcohol exposure, he's going to have ongoing needs, and the needs are going to show at different times. But because of this 50% delay regulation, and because of this new regulation that they have to assess every year, she had to assess, and because he didn't quite meet that 50% delay, she had to end services for that child who very much needed them. I also had to witness her assessing, doing an evaluation for a newborn who had just gotten out of the NICU, who had been in the NICU for 27 days. But because she was a newborn baby, it was very hard to show a 50% delay. And she had to tell that mother, I'm sorry, we can't enroll you in services, but call back in 6 months. 6 months later, right, we know that prematurely born infants have a high risk of all sorts of neurodevelopmental, feeding difficulties, breathing difficulties, motor development. But they have to wait until those developmental disabilities get worse before that baby can get the care they need. And the first year of life is the most sensitive for brain development. So the earlier you can intervene, the better. And they used to be able to intervene with newborns based on prematurity or low birth weight alone. Because of regulation now, they can't. This bill will change that. We also had to Yulia had to see. We filmed with a family who had newborn twins who were born prematurely, and she enrolled them based on prematurity. And then 2 days later, the state told her that she could no longer do that. And so then they had to go do informed clinical opinion in order to qualify her. But she was still afraid that she was going to get in trouble from the state for serving prematurely born twins who were still having feeding difficulties, who very much needed the care that they were getting from infant learning program. And just seeing how many children are being denied services because of this, this 50% requirement is really heartbreaking. But it's also clear that there will need to be funding to pay for that because they don't have the staffing they need. They don't have the contractor time that they need right now with the budget being flat funded for 11 years. So in order to expand eligibility, clearly they will need to hire more staff and more occupational therapists, speech and language pathologists, and everyone else.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Norton Cruz. Is there any questions? I don't see any. Anyone else in the room? Not seeing anyone. No one online. I'm going to close public testimony. Are there any questions or discussion before I set this bill aside? We will, of course, have it up at another future date. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I know we've said this on prior pieces of legislation, and I just want to reiterate it here again. It is unfortunate that when we approach fiscal notes, we are unable to show cost savings. With the testimony we've heard and also with our own learning about the need to provide these services to families with a lower threshold of developmental delays, it's frustrating because we're unable to clearly say to the public, if we're able to intervene early, we will be able to have better services for these young folk who then go on to do credible and successful things that do not impact the state or school resources at a later date. We do not provide or have the need to provide such intensive services for 504 plans or special education or in some cases other types of intervention. So it's one that I do think we need to just reiterate and make sure is on the public record that this bill, while it does cost us to implement it, will save us resources in the long run.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Any other discussion before we set the bill aside? Okay. I'm going to set the bill aside. We're going to go briefly at ease and set up the next presentation. Back on the record at 4:04. The next item on the agenda is Senate Bill 45 from my office. We first heard this bill way back in January of 28th for introduction and invited testimony again on April 24th when we adopted a committee substitute. Tracy Dompling, Director, Division of Behavioral Health, is available online for questions. I was wondering, do members have any questions for Ms. Dompling regarding this bill? All right. I believe we have already opened and closed public testimony. Have we noticed this bill for public testimony today?
No.
Okay. All right. I don't have any additional discussion. We basically just had this. If you remember, the director was otherwise disposed at the House Health and Social Services Committee. So that's why we had this additional hearing today. Are there any questions for her or for me? Senator Giesel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I realize we are not the Finance Committee, but I'm looking at the fiscal note, and it's gone up significantly. And I just wondered if we could find out why.
Excellent question, Senator Giesel. Ms. Dompling, did you hear the Director Dompling, did you hear the question? Director, are you there?
Mr. Chair, I am now. Thank you. The line was just unmuted. I heard most of it. I missed the beginning. There was a little bit of a garble at the beginning of the question.
So the question, and if Senator Giesel will allow me to paraphrase, we have two versions of this bill. And we had a first version that was introduced primarily by the Behavioral Health Association. Then we asked the Behavioral Health Association to work with the department to create a version that was perhaps more acceptable. And then for the CS, we received a fiscal note that was almost twice the size. Can you explain the difference in the size of the fiscal note between the first and second version?
Yes, thank you to the chair and also to Senator Giesel. In our review of this most recent version, it appeared as though there was a lot more clarification as what was being asked, what was being asked in the annual reports, what was being asked as far as, you know, the reporting out of whether there were violations with parity. You know, every 4 years, there being a larger parity analysis. And as we worked through this, you know, our team really just felt strongly that our original fiscal note and what we knew then really didn't reflect what we know now. And, you know, it's an important topic, but it's a big lift. Anything in the Medicaid system is a big lift. And so there needs to be contractual support as well as the staffing support to see this through as it's written.
I guess is that all right, Madam Vice Chair? I'll ask a follow-up question then. If we were to return to the original version, would that subsequently lower the fiscal note back to the original fiscal note?
To the chair, probably. I think what's happening is, as we start to learn more and more and more about what really are the expectations from this, I think that's what's really shedding light. And so, you know, perhaps we didn't have as strong of an understanding of what's being requested, but yes, if we went back, there was fewer reporting, fewer parity, like the full parity analyses that are happening, you know, every 4 years, then yes, there would be a lower fiscal note.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Director Dompling. Can I just ask specifically on the fiscal note for FY 2026 and FY 2031, the numbers are around 818,000 and 812,000, but in the other years it's 662,000. Why is there that discrepancy?
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, it's not a discrepancy. It's that in the off years when the full parity analysis isn't due, there is the annual reports that are due with the action plans that need to be in place. And so when we don't have the full report analysis, we don't expect to be as high of a contract with the contractor to be doing that work. And so in those years where it's lower, it's a reduced amount of contract amount, but it's still the two PCNs like throughout that entire scope.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarity.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. There are other questions for Director Dompling? Okay. It is my intention to move this bill on Thursday. We've had it for quite a long time. I'm going to set an amendment deadline for tomorrow at 5 p.m. If folks feel strongly that they need more time for an amendment, let me know and we can try to work with your office. But we have been working on this bill since January, and I think it is time that it moved from this office. Although I must express my displeasure at the notion that Behavioral Health Association went to the Department of Health. They negotiated what was supposed to be a compromise version, and then the fiscal note doubled. So we will move forward, and this will be going to Senate Finance regardless. Any other thoughts on this bill before we move to the final item on our agenda? Okay. Set this aside. We'll briefly go off the record. Back on the record is now 4:14. The final item on the agenda is Senate Bill 147 from Vice Chair Senator Giesel. We first heard this bill on April 15th, and we heard an introduction and took invited testimony, and again on April 22nd for public testimony. Having received no amendments today, it is my intention to look to the will of the committee. I want to note that we have Dr. Brandy Signamartin, the Executive Director of the AK Pharmacy Association, online for questions. Senator Giesel, do you have any comments before we begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify what the bill is about, it is a carefully crafted limited scope reform authorizing limited pharmacists to independently prescribe medications and devices related to minor illnesses, chronic disease management, and preventive care, all within the limits of their education. But, Mr. Chairman, it's important to highlight what this does not authorize pharmacists to do. It does not expand their authority beyond the services that they've been educated to perform. It does not allow pharmacists to prescribe abortion-inducing medications. That prohibition is already in current Alaska law under AS18.16.010. It simply allows pharmacists to serve patients more fully in the areas they are already trained. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor or for Dr. Signamartin? Seeing no further questions, I entertain a motion.
Senator Dunbar, I would move Senate Bill 147, version 34, LS0274/I from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, CS for SB 147 moves from committee. I'd ask folks to stay behind to sign the document. All right. The next meeting of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will be Thursday, May 1st at 3:30 p.m. We'll hear public testimony on this committee's SB 178, as well as public and invited testimony on Senator Gray Jackson's SCR 4. And I'll note that we are planning to look to the will of the committee and move SCR 4 in one hearing. And so if folks have any issues with that, please contact my office. It is a time-sensitive proclamation. So thank you, everybody, for a productive hearing. The time is now 4:17 p.m. and we are adjourned.